I'm Mel.
I'm Tiff.
And we're on Pump today with John Marinaro, who's the co-chief of UNM Center of Adult Critical Care. He's the chief of surgical critical care, the director of UNM ECMO, the director of the cardiothoracic and vascular ICU, and he also happens to be the founding president of the Society of Critical Care Medicine in New Mexico's chapter. Welcome, John.
Thank you both very much for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity to get on Pump. It sounds like a fun podcast.
Yeah, we try to keep our pump runs rather short, but you know, we're flexible.
We're always ready to crash back on if necessary.
Good. Well, that's good. And you know, just remember, every time you put a cannula in somebody, you can bill. So every time you ask me a question, we can bill for more ECMO here. So it's good.
Oh, perfect. Now you're the billing guru. So we trust you on that side of things.
So you started this. So for the listeners who don't really know about your initiatives over in New Mexico, you basically pilot, if I'm wrong, just let me know, but you've basically piloted a project for mobile ECMO at UNM where you actually go out in the ambulance and you cannulate patients pre-hospital and you bring them back on ECMO to try to get better outcomes for patients in ECPR settings.
That's correct. Yeah, we, and I say we, and it's a group of people who are very dedicated to this. There's Dr. Darren Brody, who's the EMS division chief for the University of New Mexico, and myself kind of spearheaded this program with Albuquerque Fire Rescue. And, you know, we basically, in New Mexico, we are a very resource-limited state. You know, as I've said in other podcasts, you know, our state motto is thank God for Mississippi. Otherwise, we'd be 50th in everything in this country. And the New Mexico environment is such that there are not a lot of hospitals. The population of Albuquerque, although there is a centralized population of about 700,000 in the city of Albuquerque, it can be a little more spread out. And we wanted to be able to offer ECPR across the Albuquerque metro area. And so along with Albuquerque Fire Rescue, who was kind enough to donate an ambulance, which we got it labeled ECMO 1, and we made some modifications inside, we created a pre-hospital ECMO program that is, in general, up Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., something like that. And we've been down a little bit for the holidays. They had to do some repairs on the ECMO 1 ambulance, but we're probably going to be up again next week. And you know, it's exciting.
So, John, you started these efforts before the pandemic, correct? So you didn't quite get it off the ground before the pandemic, and you were able to after the pandemic. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it was really interesting. We started, I want to say, in maybe September of 2019. We did our first pre-hospital ECMO case. We published that case report. Our ECMO, pre-hospital ECMO setup is different than other folks. So if you take Dr. Yiannopoulos in Minneapolis, Dr. Yiannopoulos is doing great work. He's got the funding for this very large kind of a cath lab on wheels where he goes to other hospitals who are in some sort of catch-all area for him. And he does ECMO cannulations at that other hospital, drives his ambulance, his kind of 18-wheeler kind of device car up, and then they wheel the patient out to him. What we did is we got this ambulance, and the ambulance will get a call for a person who has to be 35 minutes or more away from University Hospital. So these are people who would not have normally gotten to come in. Anyone greater than 35 minutes, we deemed unable to get them to University Hospital and on pump in less than 60 minutes with all the processes that have to happen. And so we said, okay, if you're outside of the ring of 35 minutes, your chance of getting on ECMO are zero. Let's go respond to that group. So we get a 911 call. We get activated that there is a cardiac arrest that's in this kind of, we drew it on a map. We have an idea. We did some mathematical modeling to figure out how far away 35 minutes would be in various different areas, because some are traffic patterns. Some are just, there's not roads accessible right away. And then the ambulance picks us up in front of the hospital. We go out to the scene and we cannulate on scene. And we did our first one, as I said, just before the pandemic. We actually did three just prior to having to shut down, you know, basically February 2020 is when we had to shut down. And then we've re-upped as of March of 2023. And since March of 2023, we've done two more that had met our criteria. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of people that meet the criteria. We have not had a survivor of the five patients we've done. We've only done five over since 2019. We did three prior and two last year. And of those five, all of them got on pump in less than 60 minutes, despite the fact they were more than 35 minutes away. No one got on with a cannulation complication. And all of them were able to flow at 3.5 to 4 liters on, believe it or not, hand crank ECMO. And I'm sure you're going to ask, what the hell is hand crank ECMO next? And I'll let you ask that question.
What the heck is hand cranked ECMO?
Okay. So again, we are not the wealthiest state in the world. We do not have a lot of funding for our ECMO stuff. We do not have the ability to put an ECMO specialist in the back of the ambulance. So we trained the firefighters to be our first assist for ECMO cannulation. So they do the help us with the wires, et cetera. And what happens is we get to the scene and the EMS people who have been working the person reverse load the person onto the stretcher. And then they roll the person feet first into the back of the ambulance, which is different. Normally it goes head first in, right? But this, they go feet first. Then the EMS physician and the paramedics are still doing airway and they're doing all that stuff at the head of the bed. We actually can do transesophageal echo in the field. Dr. Brody brings his echo out there. We do TEE in the field. And then we're sitting on that bench seat in the back of the ambulance. We actually have an ultrasound probe hanging by a bungee cord from the ceiling. We put it down, we find the vessel, you let go, you put the needle in, you get the wire in, you go grab the thing, the bungee cord, do the, you know, the artery and the vein, and then you put the wires in, and then we put the cannulas in, and then we have ECMO hooked to the hand crank. We run the Rotaflow circuit, and we basically go ahead and put them on ECMO and hand crank, because that way you don't have to set up a machine. You don't have to troubleshoot the machine. You don't have to do any of that. We have a flow probe. We put in as opposed to putting in a right radial at that point, we put in a femoral line. Femoral arterial line. So we have a flow probe saying we're getting 3 to 4 liters of flow. And we have a arterial monitor that says we have a blood pressure of hopefully 50 to 60 MAP because they're usually laminar flow. And we hand crank them back into the hospital. And then we get to the hospital. The ECMO specialists come out to the ambulance. They put the Rotaflow head into the Rotaflow. And then we offload the person into the hospital. They go to CAT scan, get top the bottom CAT scan, and then go up to the ICU. So,
wow,
that's it.
That's it. No, that's incredible.
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that we've seen is, and I'm sure all of your perfusionists have dealt with this. Like, the ECMO machine goes down sometimes, and you have to hand crank. The hand crank works. The hand crank is $5,000. The hand crank doesn't beep. It doesn't do anything. It flows just fine. And we were like, how can we make this simple? And that's how we've made it simple. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's definitely very cost effective. And I think that, like you're saying, like the simplicity of the circuit allows you to utilize a different population as a first assist, as opposed to, you know, CardioHelp is fantastic. It's got a lot of safety features, but one, it's very expensive. And two, if you're not very adept with the settings on that device, troubleshooting can take, you know, a few minutes for somebody who's not comfortable with it and you don't have help out in the field. And then, so I think it's great. I think you've done a fantastic job of innovating to meet the needs of a population that otherwise would, you know, not get access to care in an area that's very different. I actually thought, you know, it was interesting is that seeing your setup and knowing that it was a hand crank from AMSEC last year was, I wonder from your perspective, do you think that this is actually something that in the future could potentially help a major city like New York, where I am, where traffic can really impede your time to arrival at the hospital and the ED. Like you can get somebody who could have potentially survived, you know, 35 minutes out, but with traffic in New York City, especially in Manhattan, like it might take you an hour to get a few blocks down from where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's interesting. The concept of the hand crank is that my whole kind of goal in everything is to how can I make ECMO not an ivory tower thing? Like, you know, not that New Mexico UNM is an ivory tower, but we're the university hospital. Mm-hmm. We, you know, Yiannopoulos University of Minnesota is quite the ivory tower, you know, whether you're Mayo or you're, you know, UT Houston or wherever, all these big places. But what do you do in my area if you're Gallup, New Mexico, or if you're Farmington, New Mexico? People die there who don't need to die. And we are trying to get out. I've cannulated two people for ECMO in Gallup in the last 2 weeks. But that's me hopping on a plane, flying an hour or 5 minutes out there, landing, getting transported to the airport, and hoping the person's still alive by the time I get there. And so if these local places could do ECMO easier. The other thing we're doing, and even within my group, there's a lot of controversy. There's kind of like people who believe or don't believe. We're using 13 French arterial cannulas. And the people are like, oh my God, that's crazy. Well, the guys, the Japanese guys who published that 15 French data, where they went from 17 to 15, people thought they were crazy. There was an editorial in that one where a cardiac surgeon's like, well, you know, what are you going to do? What's this? Yiannopoulos' data has showed in a typical ECPR, the average flow is 3.5 liters. We can actually flow 4 to 4.5 liters through a 13 French arterial cannula. And if you can flow that much, you're going to get more people who are willing to put in ECMO cannulas if it's 13 French. If it's the size of a dialysis catheter, you're not going to freak as many ER docs out. And, you know, who knows, maybe at some point we can make this a paramedic or at least a flight nurse procedure or something like that, where you don't, you know, you don't have to have someone who's as skilled as a critical care doctor with extra years of training or a cardiac surgeon or whatever, any of the other folks who do this, cardiologists, et cetera. So that's kind of my goal, is how can we bring ECMO to the masses? Hand crank, smaller cannulas. You know, and the other thing about smaller cannulas is we don't do reperfusion cannulas very often. I actually, one of my residents and I are going over the data tomorrow, but I think out of the last 13 French ECMO cannulas we've done two reperfusion cannulas. That's it. So you still get pulses distally if a person has a 13 French, whereas if a 15 French or God knows 17 French, you're going to have to put in a reperfusion cannula, which again is another step. Another thing that has to get more people involved, adds more complications to the procedure. So in my kind of goal is how can we simplify ECMO?
So when you're getting on that airplane, so you're taking like this modified ECMO circuit with you on a plane?
No. So for when we fly places, we take the CCS people. We take our comprehensive care specialists, ECMO specialist group. They come out with us. One of them comes out. We generally fly the cardio help out to these places. Okay. And and then cannulate and then fly back.
Okay.
And we're credentialed to cannulate across the whole state. That was one of the early things we did, like in 2019. We got ourselves credentialed to cannulate in every hospital in the state. So we can fly, land, put them on ECMO, and there's no like, hey, you need emergency privileges or any of that stuff.
What other kind of bureaucratic tape did you have to go through to get this program off the ground?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The bureaucratic tape that we went through was initially when I first started this program in 2017, there had been an ECMO program based on the pediatric ICU folks since 1995 at University of New Mexico. And the only real indication those guys felt was hantavirus for adults. We have a fair amount of hantavirus here in New Mexico. And I think, you know, Dr. Crowley and Dr. Coleman, some of those early ECMO docs at our place were the first people to publish on hantavirus in the US back when they came out. It was like 93 to 95 time when they did that. And then they started putting people on ECMO for it. But what we found was, you know, around 2015, 16, we knew we had been to reanimate in San Diego with Dr. Shiner. and Belezo and Weingart, their course. And we were like, look, there's more indications for adult ECMO than just hantavirus. And we did occasional VVs, but it was like maybe two a year tops of all of our ECMOs for adults. And then in 2017, we started saying, look, we're going to put on massive PEs. We're going to do ECPRs. We're going to do way more VV. And now it's exploded and we're doing like 70 plus cases a year of ECMO, of which about maybe a third are ECPR, maybe a little more than a third. It's over half our VA. We do a lot of pulmonary embolism work. But sorry, back to your question about other things I had to get over as far as politics and administrative stuff. We had to take this concept of the pediatric people owning ECMO and bringing it into the adult world, which was, there was like a house, but the house was a little bit from the previous generation. So I was trying to build a second floor on a house that we needed kind of different wiring, different piping, and different infrastructure. And those guys were great. They helped us kind of do that, but we were a very different kind of way of thinking about doing stuff. And then we took it and we've really accelerated it. And so that was probably a big thing. The other things that we worked through is Albuquerque Fire Rescue, and Darren Brody, the EMS division chief, had a lot of politics with dealing with getting the ambulance and getting everybody trained. That was a pretty substantial thing. I know I'm going on here for a few seconds, but let me just tell you. I try not to monopolize the whole conversation, but
monopolize it. This is great.
We love it.
We actually started off by training all the 911 operators. And we said, okay, if you have this, and this. And then we went to another thing where we trained like this big paramedic group, like this is what we're going to do. Even though you're not one of the ECMO people, you're not working at Station 3 in Albuquerque, but you're going to know that if you have a person who's less than 75, who has witnessed arrest and less than 5 minutes of no-flow time, and you can get them this and this, you're going to see us flying onto the scene. And then we went and trained, and this is what we keep ongoing doing, is training the wonderful Albuquerque Fire Rescue folks that are at Station 3, and they change. So every few months, we have to train and do a new orientation and kind of how to do this stuff. And then after that, then we just keep it going. But then, let's say in March or something like that, there's going to be a new group coming through. We'll have to go down for 2 to 3 weeks while we put on 10 classes of like going over there during their lunches and during their breaks. And, and the firefighters are great. I always say, the reason why they can hand crank for 35 minutes is because, they don't make critical care doctor calendars, but they do make firefighter calendars. Those guys are like big, big, strong dudes. And so they love all this stuff, and they're a great group of people to work with. So,
That was actually a thought going through my head when you said that you had them as the first assist. And in my head, I was like, I was going to make a joke and say, like, it's a good thing you didn't bring a perfusionist, because you'd probably end up cannulating two people on ECMO in that ambulance, and it'd be your perfusionist and the original patient. Like,
exactly.
Firefighter's perfect for it.
Yeah, this is big league stuff over perfusionist heads, I think.
Yeah, you have to change job responsibilities, Like, I'd have to start lifting a little more for that.
With the hand crank, once you're flowing and make sure you have a good, 3.5-4 liters and you're having, and the thing, it's actually, and I think all of your perfusionists, I'm sure, have hand cranked people. And it's like, it's hard, but I did it for 20 minutes up in the office, and I actually stopped mostly because I was bored, not because I was tired. It was just like, okay, I think I can do this. And I mean, it's not like I'm in great shape, so I think you'd be fine. I think you guys would do just great. So,
yeah, no, I think hand cranking is a lot easier. It sounds more intimidating than it is. It's usually always in one of our on pump. And I always look at the hand crank when I check it off the list. And I always tell myself, I hope I never have to use that thing. But I have once in the past. It's not too bad.
But, we've had to do it a number of times, even when we're just traveling with, like, a couple times we brought the Rotaflow. Let's say we were like, we only have one cardio help. We have like 7 Rotaflows and a couple Centromags. And so like, I think somebody was on a cardio help and we were like, okay, we got to transfer a person to Denver. And the Denver firefighter lifted the Rotaflow and somehow flicked that little switch in the back and like turned it off. And it was like, oh crap. And like, you know, so boom, 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 they wrote it and they hand cranked the person and they couldn't really figure out and they hand cranked the person. And again, it's not like, it's not like I'm duct taping two things together to make this work. This is the official thing you use when your thing doesn't work because it works, you know? And so, you know, that's it.
Well, you're definitely posing as a poster child for the efficacy. So we appreciate that. And John, are you, so do you have other counterparts that help you with these on-call endeavors for, you know, for ECMO transports and the ambulance, or are you the primary point person for cannulation and in this situation?
No. For the pre-hospital ECMO stuff, we actually, again, so University of New Mexico has a wonderful group of EMS physicians. Mm-hmm. There's like Dr. Pruitt, there's Dr. Brody, and a number of other physicians there. And then for the ECMO cannulators, we've got Dr. Sandeep Guliani, Dr. Todd Detmer, and Dr. Eric Cry, and then myself. So four of us do it. And, you know, essentially every morning, Dr. Brody's like, all right, who's up today? And if somebody's at the hospital working that day, they're like, we'll come from, you know, meet us at the, we actually literally meet at the bus stop in front of the hospital because the ambulance just drives up. It's a little pull out. We hop into the ambulance and take off and go. And then while we're going to the scene, we're setting up the back of the ambulance for everything. But then some of us are also responding from home. And so we're like, okay, hey, I'm responding from home today or whatever. And then we'll come from home. We initially tried to get so we could have lights and sirens on our cars. And then they were like, okay, we'll let you, we did kind of this training module thing, whatever. I mean, it wasn't incredibly hard, but it was some paperwork. And we got it so that we could drive with lights on the car. But it was like a specific, like, but it was like a 2005 Ford something or other, like a Ford Bronco or something. Then they're like, you can't run red lights and you can't speed. And I'm like, well, I'd rather drive in my own car. I got a Tesla. I'd rather show up in my Tesla. I can, you know, if I can't speed and I can't run red lights, why am I going to drive a 2006 Ford Bronco if I get a chance to, you know? That was the general consensus for all the docs who do this is like, oh, we'll just take our own cars.
I love that. I don't blame you.
we'll let Elon Musk get us to the scene and see how it works out.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe he can build you some kind of ambulance hybrid that, you know, is the best of all the worlds.
That would be good. That would be good. Elon, if you're listening, send some money.
I mean, I live in Austin. A lot of his, you know, headquarters are here. I can just run on over, you know, across the street and talk to him if you want.
There you go. Good.
So that's really interesting that you talked about how you ramped up in your hospital, like on top of this, like mobile ECMO, that you guys do a lot of PE work. What was that experience like when you started?
Well, you know, going back to 2015 or 16, we had a massive pulmonary emboli who was clearly a massive pulmonary emboli, no debate, nothing like that, who died. And we were like, this is not right. There's got to be a better way. I'm sure ECMO will help. And like at the time they were like, nope, we're not doing ECMO for that disease. There's no data. There's no evidence, which again, as I tell a lot of people, like, you know, essentially in 2009, when influenza came, everybody bought a lot of ECMO machines and then influenza went away and everybody had their ECMO. And that is when the US data really took off, is when, you know, people started using it. They had ECMO machines and started using it for a lot of stuff. Before that, it was just kind of the Japanese who had a lot of ECPR data, maybe from the late 90s. And then again, some of the bigger places, I'm sure Mayo and some of the bigger places did it, but it was not the general place because there was not a lot of ECMO machines. But in 2016 or so, we had this ECMO death, or not an ECMO death, I'm sorry, massive PE death. And we were like, no. And so that's not a good thing. In January 2017, when we took over, one of our very first cases was a massive PE that we put on, and she lived. And amazingly, since 2017, if you've had a massive PE at the University of New Mexico, you have not died, unless you were already in cardiac arrest when we got there. And then only half of those are dying. But we had in 2016, 4 of 5 massive PEs that year died. And they got the TPA, they got everything, they got everything. Since 2017, January, if you've had a massive PE at the University of New Mexico, you have not died unless you did not get put on ECMO because you were like 85 or, you know, you're over 75 or end stage kidney, liver, or you were in full arrest. So either if you weren't an ECMO candidate, you died, and not 100% of the time, but a large percentage of them. And if you already arrested before we got there. So massive PE is an awesome indication for ECPR. Sorry, it's an awesome indication for VA ECMO. Once they've cardiac arrested, because there's typically a complete lock of blood going right to left on those people, CPR doesn't really help. It's almost like doing CPR in a trauma patient. Your LV is empty, and that's not the problem that you need CPR. You need to unobstruct, which is why we always push therapeutic TPA if they're in arrest or they're about to, I mean, actually, if we're not like literally going to be on ECMO before they arrest, we push, you know, 50 of TPA and then still cannulate. So we still put them on ECMO even after therapeutic TPA. And no, like literally it's crazy. The mortality is zero. And that's been huge. The other population of patients, obviously we do a lot of adult ECPRs. I did a 16-year-old ECPR, a year ago this month, and with a great outcome, an hour and 9 minutes of CPR, and an hour and 17 minutes of CPR. It took me 8 minutes to put her on. So I guess I got to her at an hour and nine. And then there was, hypothermic arrest is the other one that's amazing. We had one guy who was a cardiac arrest for 3 hours and 3 minutes. And he walked out of the hospital. He was a hypothermic arrest. So he got CPR for 3 hours with the 2 different hospitals before he got to our hospital. We have some, and the data is a little weird because we had one guy we put on 2 years apart, the same guy for a hypothermic arrest. And so he had been on twice. So like, you know, something like, you know, we've had like 14 ECPRs in 13 patients or something, you know, some kind of crazy stat like that. One of the ones I did recently was up in Gallup, and he had actually had 2 hours and 50 minutes of CPR. And they called us an hour and 20 minutes into the cardiac arrest. I flew out there, put him on ECMO at 2 hours and 50 minutes of CPR. He woke up, but then he went into multi-system organ failure and didn't make it. But he did neurologically wake up after 2 hours and 50 minutes of CPR. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask with the ECPR, like your cardiac arrest due to underlying PE patients, like typically because they have a complete cessation of blood flow to the brain, is there a downtime? Like, have you noticed like the downtime significantly shorter with that population?
Yeah, you got to get on that population really quickly. It's, you know, it's not that you don't have any survivors, because some people still will have a trickle of blood. Like, you know, they throw that massive PE, they have acute right heart failure, but there's still some getting through and they get good CPR, all this other kind of stuff. But there are some people who are just obstructed and there's just nothing getting right to left, which again is why we're like, no, still do the TPA if you have to, because anything will help. But that's a really good place for the end-tidal CO2. And if your end-tidal CO2 isn't, you know, 15 or so, then they're probably not perfusing their, no, there's no blood getting through the lungs and they're not going to be perfusing their brain. And so that is a tough one. We just had one of those last week where, you know, the guy was down, they got good CPR, but it's just your times all shrink with massive PE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now you're doing, so you're also obviously doing ECPR in the ED at UNM. Can you talk, like, how long have you been doing that? Do you guys have like an ECMO specialist bring the circuit down when you get the call? Do you try to house some equipment there? Like, what considerations have you done to try to get on, like, time to on pump faster?
Yeah, a great question. So, you know, the we have a ECMO, not cart, but like a ECMO, we have our ECMO supplies in 2 of the 3 ICUs. The only one we don't have it in is the neuro ICU. So we have it in the trauma surgical cart, which is also the cardiothoracic ICU. We have it in the medical ICU. We have it in the ER, we have it in the cath lab, and we have it in the OR. So we have 5 ECMO cards. Oh, and then one in the PICU. We have 6 ECMO cards. And then, so we go there, and that's got our, that we made an ECMO pack. And so it's like Dr. Gugliani created this thing. It's like a 7-layer bean dip. Obviously, we're in Albuquerque, so we call everything some sort of tortilla thing, some sort of, you know, some sort of New Mexico kind of theme thing. But so we open the top of the pack, and it's like your head cover, your mask, your gloves, your eye covers. And then the second layer is, you know, your drape. And then the third layer is your micropuncture and a Benson wire and an Amplatz wire. And then you pull it away, and there's another layer of a Benson wire, a micropuncture, a Benson wire. And that's, so that's like your other side. And then, you know, the next layer are your clamps, and the next layer is your bowl. And then, you know, and then, so by the time, if you get to the bottom of the thing, of the pack, you will have gone through all of your supplies, and the person should be on ECMO. The only thing that's not in the pack are your ECMO cannulas. And so you like literally just work your way top to bottom, and you get to the bottom and you're good. And everything is in there with the exception of the ECMO cannulas and the patient. We go through that. We have that everywhere. The ECMO specialists, they keep a pump in the pediatric ICU. That's kind of where their main office is. They keep a pump in the adult ICU. And then we usually have somebody on at all times. And so there's a pump that's like their backup pump that's also there. So there's like kind of a few pumps that are primed everywhere. And then the ECMO specialist basically comes down right to the ER, right to the cath lab, or right to wherever we're needing to cannulate the person. And then they just are right there helping us out. And, you know, our ECMO specialists are amazing. A guy named Justin Henson is currently running that program, and he's just doing great along with the rest of the team. So
you answered my question. That was, I was going to ask what team usually responds in-house for your ECMOs, and whether or not perfusion is involved, or if it's fully ECMO specialist run in addition to critical care.
Yeah. So there is one perfusionist, Angela Akbarpour, who is actually, you know, there's like a lead ECMO specialist, and then she's the lead perfusionist. And I think she's actually kind of technically over everything, and she's wonderful. She comes and does ECMO cases and ECMO starts up too, but she's actually typically in the OR doing cardiac cases along with the other kind of perfusionists who are doing that. But essentially most of our program is run by the ECMO specialists. We have respiratory therapists and nurses are our ECMO specialists, with, again, occasional perfusionists if they're not in the OR, but it's primarily a specialist and, or sorry, a nurse and RT grouping. And they're wonderful. We have been working together so closely now for 6+ years. And it's, you know, they know exactly what you're going to need before you need it. You know, they're like handing you what you want, which is great. And they're frequently like, hey, you got to get the heparin. Oh, you got to, you know, because, you know, you're kind of in your, I'm in my zone of cannulating, and they're doing that. And so they're wonderful and keep us on track. Once the person's on ECMO, they're obviously assuring that if we're doing the resuscitation, you know, what can they give through the machine? What can they, you know, let's get the cerebral oximeters on the head, get them on the legs and all that kind of stuff. Then that's where they really take over. And they're like, let's get to the CT scanner. Let's get from the CT scanner up to the ICU or up to the cath lab, usually if it's a STEMI, and go from there. So.
And do you normally have an, I'm sorry, Mel.
Go ahead.
Do you normally have an ECMO specialist in-house 24/7, or do they respond to calls as well from home?
So obviously if there's people on pump, and there's generally people on pump at all times, there's somebody in house 24 hours a day. If they're not, they're there from 7 a.m. until, I want to say, 10 or 11 p.m. Constantly. And then overnight, they're on call. I think more, and I might be off on my numbers a little bit there, but, you know, they're ever present. And if they come in, they're only 30 minutes away. And we have not had to ever hand crank at the hospital. They get in there fast enough. We also get, if you're the ECMO, if I was on ECMO call tonight and I was at home, right? So like we have like 8 or 9 cannulators. I'm working to expand the cannulator pool, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, but we have 8 or 9 kind of primary cannulators. And if I was on call tonight, no ECMO cannulator was in house, I get an alert on every cardiac arrest that's coming to University Hospital. So I'm usually knowing about 15 minutes in advance, and they're like, 55-year-old guy arrested in front of the paramedics, CPR started. Then I call the ECMO specialist and we're both coming in and meet, and we meet right at the hospital. And so usually it's pretty darn quick, but often they're in the hospital because we always have patients on. You generally have patients on.
So do you get all these calls at the moment because you're still building out the program? Like, are you looking at some point with the establishment and the stabilization of this program to have like your cannulator or whichever cannulator's on call on this, like the STEMI or the shock call, like the initial call coming in from the EMS, like straight to them instead of funneled through you so that you can.
No. That's what I mean. Like if I was the doc on call, so any of the eight.
Okay. I thought you meant like all of you. When do you sleep?
That was the first 2 years that I think I did that. But after that, again, like if you are the guy or gal who's on call for ECMO cannulation, then you get 100% of cardiac arrest. Every cardiac arrest that occurs at University Hospital or that's coming into the hospital or every massive PE, they get an alert out and boom, they go. The things that I get typically still as director called for that tends to kind of bypass stuff is if there's a transfer from like someone's got to fly out to Gallup or something like that. I tend to do a little more of that coordinating because there's just a little more like, well, how can you do this? It's just a lot more people to call. And it happens 5 times a year versus 20 times a week. So because it's kind of rarer, I still kind of get my hands in a lot of that. A lot of my docs have young kids and all these other things. My kids are all grown. And so it's a little different for me to be able to take these calls 24 hours a day and stuff like that. But again, my team is wonderful. They're all like, it's for the 20 plus activations or something we have a week, which again, some of them are just, you'll get one that's like 85-year-old guy found down in nursing home and you're just, we ignore it, right? We don't do anything. But sometimes it's 55-year-old guy and you get there and the person's 85 and they were found down in a nursing home, but the story's wrong. But you do your stuff that way. And then again, pretty much all hypothermic arrests are like, we just drive in. Obviously, some guy could be pretty old for that too, but those like there's every you like as soon as you're like hypothermic arrest, you just call the ECMO specialist and you're both just coming in to go. And we do the HOPE score on those people. I assume your listeners may not know what the HOPE score is. It's like the hypothermic outcome score. And you can basically predict their chance of survival. And as long as basically their potassium is low, the score is a lot of different, it's like 6 different things, but the potassium is huge. If your potassium is like 4 and you've been having like 2 hours of CPR, you still have like a 70% survival. It's that potassium is the real marker for their survivability chance. So
this may be like a dumb question, but with the hyperkalemia, is it like inability to get the potassium off, or is that just like a serum marker for greater damage that's irreversible there?
That's like a greater marker for they've been dead longer. They're dead and they're not being like, again, you guys obviously as perfusionists do your deep hypothermic arrest when you're doing a major arch procedure, and those people, they're in like suspended animation. But if your like potassium's, I think it's over 12 or something like that, then your body has been warm and dead and you just happen to be cold now, right? Versus you arrested, you're cold, you're a hypothermic arrest. Literally, you just go on to your, Google and on your phone and see HOPE score. And it's a really cool score. I mean, there's also like a rest score and a save score. There's all these different scores you can do. Save scores for ECPR, rest scores for VV ECMO, and the HOPE score is for hypothermic arrest. And there's probably more scores that I just don't know about. So,
I feel like I learned a lot about that. I was not aware about all those different scores for different types of ECMO. So thank you. I think our listeners will really appreciate that information. And so similar to on call for ECPR, you seem to be on call for podcasts in general. This isn't your first rodeo. I think you've done a podcast for UNM Health as well as ED ECMO, which we both, Mel and I, did listen to. And so I just wanted to have you summarize a little bit what you talked about in those podcasts about the inception trial and the arrest trial and how those negative ECMO studies can be used to your advantage to benchmark a center for excellence.
I'm not going to be able to dive too deep into it because obviously just like you guys, before you do a podcast or something, you kind of read all the literature. So you're kind of up to date on it. But essentially, I think with some of the trials that are out there and like some of the ones out of Europe that maybe didn't show a benefit, you can kind of look at them and say, well, why did it not show a benefit? Maybe it didn't show a benefit because of the fact that they did it over too many hospitals, or they instigated it too late, or they had a situation where it was not quite being instigated fast enough. Then you can look at Yiannopoulos's trial, which ended up stopping early, where it's a single center. It's a guy, and it's Jason Bartos and Dimitri Yiannopoulos, who are master cannulators. And they also tend to have a population of patients. They were doing VFib and VTAC, I think, only in their patients, witnessed arrest down this. They had 100% survival, I believe, if it was less than 30 minutes, and then it kind of dropped off. They typically have a population of patients they're going at who are maybe like a healthier group, or they're, you know, kind of things like that. The New Mexico population of patients is probably not quite as healthy as the Minneapolis population of patients, which I think is that. I think some of the European trials also have incredibly healthy populations of patients. There's less obesity over there. It's definitely less drug use. Some of these different changes there make it so some of these trials are working and some of these are not. What I would say overall to the listeners about ECPR is 8.5% is what a 500,000 cardiac arrests as an out of hospital cardiac arrest, 500,000 a year, 8.5% of those patients are surviving neurologically intact, right? That's it, 8.5%. So when you look at the ELSO database, you look at our data, you look at data from around the places, and everybody's around 30%. Again, you can have Yiannopoulos who's like at 50%, and you can have other people who may be lower or somewhere in there. But most places are around 30%. We've been doing this now since 2017, late 2017, our true ECPR program. And we are like 29 to 31, depending on exactly when. Early in last year, we were at 57% survival. We had like five survivors in a row. It was awesome. We were like, oh, this is great. But then you kind of level out and you get down. And if you're comparing 8.5% survival neurologically intact to 30% survival, ECPR works. ECPR is a good thing. And as my son Jalen says, you know, Dad, you're trying to make CPR look like bloodletting. Like the way we're going to think about CPR in regular CPR in 15 years is that is like bloodletting. You should be getting people on ECMO and you should be getting it on fast. And can we get it so paramedics cannulate? Can you get it so ER docs are cannulating? Can you get it so it's not just cardiologists and critical care docs who are only going to be there after 30 to 60 minutes of a cardiac arrest? How can you get this so you're like Paul Pepe and Lance Becker, the guys who did the defibrillators in the airport, right? How can you get this so it's really, really quick? I actually give a talk called, you know, death is no longer a chronic problem. And it's just like, I've got this video of a guy walking along, he arrests, his AED goes, or not his AED, his implantable defibrillator goes off, and he stands up and walks away. It's like that guy was dead and now he's alive. You do not have to die from cardiac arrest anymore. And if you look at what Zach Shiner's doing in San Diego right now, they've trained all 100, 150 or something ER docs in the Sharp Memorial system to cannulate for ECMO. It is no longer considered acceptable to be like, I don't do that. If you're an ER doc in the Sharp Memorial system in San Diego and a person is 50, you know, less than 75, or I can't remember what their age limits are, but whatever they have, you're going on ECMO 24 hours a day, you're not waiting for the cardiac surgeon or the intensivist or the cardiologist to do it. They're doing it straight out of the ER. And that is the future, if you ask me, is spreading this out, making it simpler, 13 French cannulas, set up packs, smaller this, smaller that, less damage. That is the future, if you ask me, of ECPR, because when you have, there's not too many things in medicine where you more than almost four times the survival from death. I mean, that's a pretty impressive thing. I'll get off my soapbox. That's my thing.
Stay up there.
Yeah, I know. No, that is, it's incredible. I'm truly speechless. I think our audience for perfusion really needs to hear this, and we're helping to start a program in Austin. So I'm taking a lot of mental notes right now. And I think you had mentioned you worked with a Houston group on a project.
Yeah, they were on our podcast yesterday, and I don't know their whole details and stuff, but they sound like they're kind of ramping up some stuff there. And our podcast wasn't about this, but she was on this, and we were kind of talking a little bit offline about it. And so I don't know if I know all the details of what they're doing. But the other big one is Lionel Lambert in Paris and Alice Foote. They've been doing pre-hospital ECMO since like 2011, I think. And, you know, you can see pictures of them cannulating on the floor of the Louvre and cannulating, you know, in some guy's apartment building. They do full cut down. They actually, you know, do a complete open cut down ECPR cannulation technique. And, you know, Lionel's, you know, Dr. Lambert and Dr. Hooten out there are really the people who kind of postulated this as being really possible and went from there. And now it's spreading around. Obviously, we did the first North American case. Yiannopoulos is doing his, and Yiannopoulos has had a lot of saves doing his process. Again, it's different population. It's pretty rare for my cardiac arrest population to be like a guy out playing tennis in the arrest. It's just not the usual population we're putting on ECMO here. So not that they don't have great outcomes with all their patients, but they have great outcomes with Yiannopoulos and Bartos. So.
It's interesting to me that you guys don't have like a nice spike in arterial pressures when you finally put them on ECMO, with the ACLS protocols having, you know, drugs that act like vasopressors in the protocol, you know, and if it's not circulating, then when you finally get on ECMO, you're kind of sucking all of that right back into the ECMO and then delivering it arterially. So it's kind of interesting that you haven't seen that phenomenon, like a clampdown effect.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we basically, as soon as we get a person on ECMO, we're putting them on the equivalent of 10 mics per minute of epi and levofed, like two, just put them on, right? It's actually, I think it ends up being like, you know, 0.2 mics per kilo per minute or whatever, of what they're dosing. The paramedics use mics per minute and the hospital uses mics per kilo per minute. So it's basically the paramedics are doing like 10 mics of epi and 10 mics of levo. But no, we don't really see that. And one of the things that's really important to realize is there was a trial in I think it was the late 90s, called the OPALS trial, where they basically said, they showed that BLS plus defibrillation versus BLS plus defibrillation plus ACLS, there was no difference in outcomes. Epi, lidocaine, atropine do not move the needle on survival at all in cardiac arrest. Okay. They just don't. It's study after study. And as a matter of fact, more and more people are showing that epinephrine is probably leading to a worse outcome. Dr. Lionel Lambert, when you go out there and I get the opportunity and the great pleasure of teaching for him a couple times a year, they do an animal lab and they're like pushing epi and watching brain perfusion and all sorts of stuff. And like the brain just gets the vessels just crushed when you push epi. And it's like, epi is bad for the brain. And then you got Paul Pepe, who's doing heads up CPR work. Basically, they're putting the head of bed up at 30 while they're doing CPR. And they're showing great outcomes because, you know, they're like showing that, you know, the problem with some of CPR is, you know, if you're giving epi, you're constricting the vessels in the head. And then if you put their head up, you're allowing the blood to drain out of the head. And so we've probably been doing this wrong for so many years of like, lay the guy flat, push lots of epi. Now they're like, stop pushing epi. I mean, you still got to do ACLS, but they're showing more and more epi is probably bad for you. But put your head a bed up to allow venous drainage so the arterial blood can go up and around when you're doing CPR. And you know, I want to say it was a small study he did, but it was, you know, they basically had in asystolic patients, they actually had a 2.4 times increase in survival of doing heads up CPR. Paul Pepe, by the way, is in that Austin area. I don't know if you know how to get a hold of him, but that guy's a great lecturer. He's a great jazz pianist. He sings. He's wonderful. He's a wonderful guy.
We got a hold of you, John. I will do my best. So okay. Anything's possible.
You should, yeah. You let Paul Pepe play some jazz piano for you. He's amazing.
All right. I'll add that to the list.
I really wanted to talk to you about like time to initiation. Like a lot of studies have kind of across the board been along the same wavelength of saying that time to initiation plays a big role in survivability. But there's also been this kind of growing camp in some centers in ECPR that are saying oxygenation level during that initial reperfusion in ECPR going on pump plays a role in neurologic function like afterwards. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I think some of it is your PO2. The higher your PO2 is in your brain, and I'm not sure if it's oxygen-free radicals or exactly the mechanism behind it, but I want to say that some of the data is if your PO2 is like greater than 150 in that first hour after going on, your neurologic outcomes are worse. And so, and it might be 250, I can't remember the exact number, but it's somewhere in there. If your PO2 after an ECPR is 300, you are way overshooting and you're actually possibly there's a signal that you may be causing damage to the brain by doing that. And, you know, there's a fair amount of work coming up that a lot of the stuff we thought was like, yeah, more oxygen, more epi, more whatever is may not be the right things for these people. You know, as I started to mention, I kind of may have lost track of my conversation. When they started getting the influenza, we got all these machines. We were like, everybody's doing ECMO. We're still at the infancy of ECMO and ECPR in the adult population. And for people to think that, oh man, things are settled. Nothing is settled. Nothing is settled. How much oxygen? I don't know. How fast to correct the PCO2? That's another thing. You know, we typically always did 4 liters of sweep with 4 liters of flow, like a VQ of one, right? There, you really don't want to do that because if you all of a sudden blow off all that PCO2, you have a sudden vasoconstriction. If a person's PCO2 was 90 or 100, and then you bring them to 40 in whatever, a minute or 2 minutes, whatever it takes an ECMO circuit to do that, you're going to cause sudden vasoconstriction that you of the cerebral vessels that you may not want to do. So there's signals in too much oxygen, there's signals in too much reversal of hypercarbia, there's signals in epi, there's signals in doing CPR flat, but everything is up for debate, right? And that's why you can be crazy like me and 2/3 of my group think I'm insane for doing 13 French cannulas, but another part's like, maybe it's working. But don't think that anybody has settled anything. What's the best pre-hospital method? Is it like the guys, Dinas, I'm killing his name, but Dinas in the Netherlands, who's doing his method? Is it Lionel Lammet doing the full cutdown method? Is it Dr. Yiannopoulos and Dr. Bartos doing the big cath lab on wheels? Is it me doing, you know, kind of low level hand crank ECMO? Is it Zach Shiner doing, you know, 150 ER docs trained ECMO? Who knows? We don't know.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to correct that and say high level hand crank ECMO.
The hand cranking.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was going to ask, I mean, I know we're mostly past the pandemic, but did you have any anomalies or did you treat any patients with multi-system inflammatory disorder where you had to approach ECMO differently or ECPR differently?
I mean, during the pandemic, we shut down a lot of our ECPR and the only thing we kept doing was massive PEs. We did hypothermic arrests and we did, like, you know, if they were arresting in the cath lab, like, you know, like in front of us kind of stuff like that, we stopped a lot of that. As far as what did COVID cause, we didn't do new ECPR on COVIDs really at all. And obviously that's not happening anymore, but if they just happen to have COVID and they code, but if otherwise they're usually, you know, the PEs in COVID were a little bit different than regular PEs and the respiratory failure. You know, a person who dies of respiratory failure is usually a bad ECMO candidate because they're dying of hypoxia, not dying of because their heart stopped. And that's not a good group of patients. The one thing that we are doing more of is this cytokine storm. We're doing plasmapheresis on our ECMO. And so we're doing kind of more and more of that. I want to say it's plus minus. You know, there's not that many patients, but obviously if you have a person who is in florid kind of cytokine storm, like, you know, they're just incredibly vasodilated, you're throwing the sink at them, you're adding steroids, all these other things, and you think that they just might be in some sort of cytokine storm, we're adding plasmapheresis to those patients through the ECMO circuit generally.
So in my... at my previous center, we did trial using the CytoSorb during the pandemic period. Granted, it definitely filtered off a lot more than what we wanted. So I'm not sure if we could conclude that it was 100% successful or not. But I was just curious if your center had ever considered using CytoSorb, or I know plasmapheresis is a great option. Known option.
We did not do CytoSorb, but I think if I remember right, the data on CytoSorb was that it did not work. In the actual studies, again, you know, sometimes it can be hard to design a study that can maybe hit everything. I am happy to have gone through COVID once. I don't ever want to go through another pandemic. Hopefully I'm retired before that next pandemic comes, unless, you know, just it was, that was just a painful process. You know, the guys in Chicago, and I want to say the guys in the Alfred in Australia had pretty good outcomes on their VV ECMOs for COVID. We just did not do that well with our VV ECMOs, possibly population, possibly other reasons, but we didn't do well. Maybe we waited too long. Maybe, you know, the guys, I want to say it was somebody in Texas, I'm blanking on his name. I think it starts with a V. He didn't even intubate a guy and put him right on VV ECMO. And, you know, that was an interesting way of like, hey, let's not even put an airway in this guy. And that guy got through. But the guys in Chicago swore by their ECMO process and they had great outcomes. And I think, and guy Josh Isle, who runs the Alfred program, they had great VV ECMO outcomes on COVID, but we were not that fortunate here to have good outcomes. So.
What advice do you have for centers that are considering pre-hospital ECMO or ECPR for center of excellence?
So I think the pre-hospital ECMO, I think that's a step that's like ECMO 4.0, not ECMO 1.0. So if you're starting an ECPR program at your hospital, that's great. I'm fully supportive of all these other things. I think doing the pre-hospital is like, why does it work in Albuquerque? It works in Albuquerque because of Darren Brody and his relationship with the paramedics. And we have a small city, Albuquerque Fire Rescue and all that kind of stuff. Dr. Pruitt, et cetera, they do great work of kind of centralizing everything, how we do it. If you're Yiannopoulos and you're doing that pre-hospital, the way they do it is because of the fact that they've got it really well organized and all that other stuff. I'm not sure about Houston, et cetera. Paris, again, it's a very, the way they have it set up is very good. So pre-hospital ECMO is a beast that I don't recommend unless you have a really good pre-hospital EMS relationship set up and you've been doing a lot of other ECMO. For in-hospital ECMO, the things you need to do are you need to have a good relationship with your cardiologists, your vascular surgeons, and your trauma surgeons. We published a paper a few years ago about the amount of CPR damage that occurs. And, you know, we have a lot of like laparotomies on ECPR patients for liver lacerations and for splenic injuries and for stuff like that. People have to be in it to win it. You have to, believe it or not, have trauma surgeons who are into this. And then once you're putting people on, you got to really keep your indications narrow. I think every program has done this where like we started off really narrow indications and had a great first year. And then we got cocky. In our second year, we had shitty outcomes because we were choosing people that shouldn't. And then we reeled it back in. And there's this constant reel in, reel out, reel in, reel out, where we, we've gone too far, bring it back in, bring it out, bring it in. And you kind of are finding your way. I think our variability has dropped. So it kind of, we're less V tacky and more of a fine V fib on our outcomes. You know, we don't have huge ways anymore. But I think you have to have very, very distinct things in your first year. I recommend a very small group of cannulators your first year. I recommend going to Reanimate or to the ELSO courses or other courses where you learn to cannulate from people. I recommend keeping it simple and trying to create, like, again, we created this ECMO pack. I think a lot of different hospitals have, a lot of programs have their own thing. And then you're going to need to have either your in-house nurses or a perfusionist group or a contract with an out-of-hospital one like CCS or Innovative ECMO Concepts out of Colorado Springs, John Mehal. Like, there's different groups who can do all these things and then try to just grow it slowly. But if you try to just be like, we're going to do this, you're going to fail. And it's going to be a spectacular fail that your hospital is going to be like, don't ever do that again. And then you're not going to get the bite at the apple for 10 years or something. So
I like that you underscored how you were able to do so many cannulations without cannulation complications. And I wonder if it was almost like, from my perspective, like downplaying the importance of how strong of a cannulator you have for this type of procedure, you know, because it's one thing to do it on a patient with good vessels. It's another thing to do it on a patient where you don't even know what their vessels are like. It's a third thing to do it on a patient whose vessels are clamped down. You could accidentally do VV instead of VA, you know what I mean? Because of how the anatomical positioning of the femoral vessels. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, just so people have an idea, like how many ECMOs you've been doing in for other indications prior to taking on a monster like pre-hospital ECMO and cannulating in the field. Because you make it sound so simple, but it's got to be really hard.
Everything you said is completely right. Those are all difficult aspects of it. One of the things we do, and we basically put femoral art line and femoral venous line in every cardiac arrest that comes into the hospital. First of all, you manage cardiac arrests, just basic CPR, much better when you are doing all of your access and getting femoral art line and femoral venous line. You get good pressure tracings. You know your CPR is effective. Your Lucas compression device is in the right spot. All of that stuff. And so, but you also get a lot of practice putting in a lot of vascular access on cardiac arrests. And, you know, admittedly, I don't do this now, but because I've been cannulating for 7 years. But when we bring our new docs on, we're like 100% of the cardiac arrests you respond to in the hospital, put in a femoral art line, a femoral venous line. And, you know, don't let them pronounce the person until you've done that. You know what I mean? So that you get it. And we have our vascular surgeon, Dr. Gugliani, who works with us. He's critical care, vascular and trauma. So it's a great combination. He basically reviews everybody's access sticks on the CAT scans, because most of these patients end up getting CAT scans. And he'll be like, oh, you're too low or you're too high or that was right spot or this, that, and the other. We always do micropuncture and then follow it with a Benson wire to make sure that the wire goes all the way up to the heart. And I know you guys are perfusionists, but I'm not sure how much you guys go about. Like, a Benson wire is stiffer than like a central line wire, and it's got a floppy tip. And then there's a Rosen wire, which is even slightly stiffer than that. And they're 0.35 wires, and it's got a little pigtail on it. We make sure the wire goes all the way up to the heart, and you can echo and see the wire in the heart or in the IVC to make sure you're in the right spot. Then we pull that wire out, and then we follow it with a J-tip Amplatz wire. So that's a stiffer wire that you can then advance a cannula over. But we don't use like 30-centimeter wires. We're using 150-centimeter wires so that we know that we are not off into the hepatic vein. We're not off into some weird pelvic vein, and you're going to jam a cannula and go up and cause problems. Put in a common femoral vein and a common femoral artery, micropuncture, put a soft wire up, make sure it goes in the right distance, pull that wire back out, put your Amplatz up, and then dilate over your amplats and go. And we do that. I mean, again, as I've been doing this longer, probably the four pre-hospital people, we go right to the amplats, but we're also very used to feeling we've all cannulated so much that we have a good idea of what it feels like. But as we bring new docs on, we're like, do this steps every time. It'll keep you out of trouble. And then again, we do a lot of transesophageal echo in the ER. We do a lot of transesophageal echo in the ICU. And we do try to do transesophageal on almost all of these in the pre-hospital setting. So
what's next for you?
What's next for me? Probably have a nice glass of Sangiovese and then have a glass of wine. But in ECMO, what's next for me?
I like number one, but yes.
But my wife and I are studying for our WSET one level one, which is like the Wine Spirit Educational Trust thing. We're working on our wine tasting abilities here. But the thing that is probably next for me in ECMO is to get our 13 French data published. Again, I don't. Like some of the stuff I'm looking at is like, you know, the main knock on the 13 French cannula is if you need to flow 5 or 6 liters because the person's having a horrible surge response or you're on a ton of vasopressors after that, you know, then a 13 French is not enough. And my argument would be is, well, then just why in another 13 French and do bifemoral common femoral artery 13 Frenches, which is probably like a 19 French then, and you'd be able to flow a ton. And then, you know, but in general, most people after an ECPR, 3.5-4 liters is plenty. And that 13 French does that. So that is my argument for wanting to do that. The other thing is I think most people don't realize how long their ECMO circuit is from groin to the pump, to the oxygenator, back to the other groin. I measured ours and they're like 16 feet. It's like 8 feet of tubing because it goes down the leg, down the groin. It's at the bottom of the bed and then it goes back up. And, you know, length is in the denominator of the Hagen-Pussoe formula for flow. And, you know, so we're starting to look at maybe if there's a way to shorten the length of the entire circuit, could you get away with a 13 French ECMO cannula by just shortening the length and maybe you could even flow higher. And so I have kind of all my Marinero crazy ideas that get me in trouble with my group, but occasionally moves the needle forward. So that's what I think is next is trying to figure out how to simplify ECMO circuits so that anybody can do it. And the first step of that to me is getting smaller cannulas that need less reperfusion cannulas, can cause less damage and will freak out less doctors or people placing them because they're not so big. But again, the jury's still out. It seems like it's working, but I'm not 100% sure. We'll see what the data shows.
Very interesting. I'm excited to see that study come out.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get it submitted in the next like month or so.
I'm also not excited because if you start convincing cardiac surgeons in the adult population to use 13 Frenches, I might just have to retire at the age of 32.
if you can ever convince a cardiac surgeon, you let me know. No, I'm just joking.
Oh yeah,
I love
our. I'll use all the small cannulas. I work in pediatrics, so I'm accustomed to it. I'll continue the work for you, Mel.
Yeah, I haggle for sizing up every day.
Well, I mean, it is nice when you can flow 6.5 liters, yeah. Sure. But that's.
You don't need to.
Right. But, you know, if you don't need to, and if you do that, you create other problems.
For sure.
Then, you know, and again, you know, the jury's still out. I will tell you again, there are 2/3 of my group think I'm crazy. And I'm like, look, you don't have to do it. I'll do it. You know, that kind of thing. So
for what you're saying in the setting that you just need to get, I liked how you said it in the other podcast episode that I was listening to earlier, that you were saying the amount of flow that you get from CPR versus the amount of flow you get on ECMO, like the solution might lie somewhere in between. And for that, the 13 French is a perfect solution because you don't necessarily might not need 100% flow on that patient. You might just need sufficient perfusion to keep them going until you can get them stabilized at your hospital.
Yeah. All you're trying to do is beat CPR, right? Yeah. Just beat bloodletting. We beat bloodletting. We're going to be good.
If you have any final, you could give a center just one piece of advice, only one, what would it be as a final parting note?
Stick to your inclusion and exclusion criteria if you're new. And if you're old doing, I mean, not new or old in life, but new or old in your program, so your inclusion and exclusion criteria, hold firm on it, because the hardest thing about starting a program is you're going to have people who are going to pressure you into putting people onto ECMO. You're going to have people who are going to pressure you into doing ECMO cannulations on people that are 76, that are, you know, oh, it's just this, it's just that. And so stick to your inclusion exclusion criteria, my one bit of advice.
That's beautiful. John, we really appreciate crazy here. So with that said, I know you had a pretty long day and you just got home and flew from another part of the nation. So, or country, I don't know where you were. But yeah, we just wanted to express our sincere gratitude for joining us today and sharing your invaluable insights into the world of mobile ECMO and the groundbreaking work happening at the University of New Mexico. Your dedication to advancing the field and revolutionizing ECMO truly inspires us all. On behalf of our listeners and the medical community, thank you for your time, expertise, and commitment to saving lives. We look forward to following your continued success and innovations in ECMO and look forward to the paper that you're about to publish here pretty soon.
Hopefully. Yeah. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, both of you, and to speak to your listeners. And again, you know, just remember the disclaimer that this is, no one has cornered the market on what is right in ECPR. It is still very up for debate. And join the debate club, you know, feel free to, you know, to venture out and try some stuff, because it's just not, everything is up for debate. But thank you guys very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys very much. I really appreciate it. And it's super nice to see you again, Melissa and Tiffany. It's nice to meet you. And please, you know, if you see me at a conference, come grab me and go from there. I really enjoyed getting a chance to speak at AMSEC. That was a great talk. So
We appreciate having you. Thank you so much. Enjoy your Sangiovese. Enjoy your night.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. Talk soon. Bye. That's a wrap for this episode, your source for all things perfusion. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to cover, please send us an email at pumpcasters@gmail.com. Until next time, keep the blood flowing and an eye on your level. From the latest techniques to the biggest challenges and trends, we cover it all on Pump, the perfusion podcast that never misses a beat.